Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says as long as protecting the security and superiority of Israel is a priority for U.S. presidents, there will be no peace and stability in West Asia. Iran's president warns the U.S. against undermining regional security, saying Tehran will give a harsh response to any mistake by Washington or its allies. Also ahead, new official data show the number of unemployment benefit claims in the U.S. has hit an 8-month high amid rising interest rates and tighter financial conditions. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran says there will be no peace and stability in the West Asian region as long as protecting security and superiority of Israel is a priority for the U.S. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Iran considers its neighbor's security as of its own security. Nasser Kanani pointed to a recent declaration by Israeli and U.S. leaders of putting anti-Iran stance on their agenda. He noted that the declaration is aimed at targeting not just Iran, but securing Israel's hegemony over Islamic and Arab states. The statement was signed during U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to Tel Aviv. Washington has reiterated that it remains committed to Israel's security, especially the regime's qualitative military edge in the region.
U.S. President Joe Biden has touched down in West Asia. First stop, Israel. He will visit Saudi Arabia next. Meanwhile, it has emerged that his administration is considering lifting the ban on the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. However, reports say the final decision over the issue is expected to hinge on whether Riyadh makes progress towards ending the war in neighboring Yemen.
This decision, supposedly hinging on whether or not Saudi Arabia makes sufficient political progress towards a negotiated solution with Yemen, as articulated, is in fact absurd. It's completely backwards. Rather than forcing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, what it does instead is, of course, fortifies the lethality of the Saudi military, and it also, as well, gives it increased leverage at the bargaining table.
According to media reports, senior Saudi officials pressed their U.S. counterparts to scrap a policy of selling only defensive arms to the Persian Gulf Kingdom in several meetings in Riyadh and Washington in recent months. In February 2021, Biden said he was ending support for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, a policy that included a ban on the sales of offensive weapons. But it was later revealed that U.S. contractors were still maintaining Saudi warplanes that were bombing Yemen. And the Biden administration approved the sale of air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in November 2021.
Therefore, if the United States actually seeks to end the genocidal war against the people of Yemen, this decision to continue offensive arms sales such as precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is the exact opposite of what it should in fact be doing.
That's why one of Biden's main objectives will be to get Riyadh to increase cooperation with Israel. Although full normalization is not expected, Saudi Arabia could take a step in that direction by allowing Israeli flights in its airspace or by quietly increasing military cooperation to counter Iran. While in Israel, talk of military support for the regime was a priority for Biden.
Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia does not bode well for his critics within and outside the U.S. He has been criticized for trading human rights for arms sales and for not addressing issues like the Khashoggi assassination, despite the CIA confirming it happened on a direct order from the Saudi Crown Prince. Additionally, Biden is pushing to reset ties with Riyadh since the U.S. desperately needs Saudi oil.
At home, any move to rescind restrictions on offensive weapons is sure to draw opposition in Congress, including from Biden's fellow Democrats and opposition Republicans who have been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If it does not yield to providing Saudi Arabia with more weapons, the kingdom may not have an appetite to reset relations with the US at this point in time. Let's not forget, as a presidential candidate, Biden denounced Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Yet, Biden's approach has softened since the start of Ukraine war, which has prompted the United States and other Western countries to appeal to Saudi Arabia to pump more oil to offset the loss of Russian supplies.
Well, you know, due to U.S.-sponsored sanctions on some of the world's largest oil producers, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, President Biden is facing a crisis that is largely of his own making and that of the United States. Therefore, he comes to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia essentially as a supplicant with his hand outstretched to plead for increased oil production. President Biden, unfortunately, does not have any vision or plan for the Middle East.
The Saudi regime is considered one of the most despotic regimes in the West Asia region, which routinely violates the rights of dissidents. It has engaged in a brutal war against Yemen, which has killed thousands of people, including countless women and children.
Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the Swedish chargé d'affaires in Tehran to lodge strong protests over a Swedish court's life sentence ruling for Iranian national Hamid Nouri. Iran called the ruling illegal that violates international law and sovereignty of states, adding that the court lacked jurisdiction over the case. Iran's ministry said the evidence presented in the court was provided by MKO, a terrorist group which is behind the killing of over 17,000 Iranians. It also slammed the Swedish court for giving a platform to terrorists and that the ruling was in effect an attempt to whitewash MKO's terror activities. The ministry further noted that Hamid Nouri has served 2 years illegal incarceration and called on Sweden to immediately release him. Tehran says Nouri has gone through various physical and mental pressures in solitary confinement that amount to torture and violations of basic human rights. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has dismissed the Swedish court ruling in the case of Iranian national Hamid Nouri.
The Islamic Republic of Iran strongly condemns this political statement, which makes way for baseless and fabricated accusations against Iran and its judicial system, and contains the life sentence against Hamid Nouri.
Nasser Kanani also said the verdict was a pretext for political action without substantiated evidence and legal validity. Kanani said the court ruling shows Sweden as a safe haven for terrorist groups to operate with the support of the judicial system. Earlier, the Swedish court handed down a life sentence to the Iranian citizen. Hamid Nouri was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violations against MKO members back in the 1980s. Last month, in a short phone call with his family, Nouri said he was tortured while in prison and denied medical attention despite his deteriorating physical condition. Iran's president warns the United States and its allies that any mistake by them in West Asia will meet a harsh response.
The great nation of Iran will neither accept any crisis or insecurity in the region, nor any mistake by the Americans. I am telling the United States and its allies in the region that any mistake made in this region will meet with a harsh response that will make them regret their wrongdoing.
Raisi said Iran's defense capabilities have brought security to the region. The president also said interference by foreigners, the U.S. in particular, will only jeopardize regional security. Raisi warned Israel that normalization with certain Arab states in the region will never guarantee the regime's security. The Iranian president also censured some regional states for playing into the hands of Western countries and importing instability and terrorism to West Asia. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi said Iran is currently stronger than any time in history, while the U.S. is in its weakest position. He censured Washington for pursuing its so-called maximum pressure against Iran. Raisi said even U.S. officials themselves have admitted that such a policy has failed, quote, miserably. Torrential rains continue to wreak havoc in several Indian states, killing nearly 24 people and displacing millions more. The fresh deluge in Maharashtra state has caused riverbanks to burst and sewage to flood homes. Shops in many cities are closed while thousands of residents are evacuated. The weather department has issued a red alert for several districts. At least 18 people, including 6 children, have been killed in Maharashtra, Gujarat, and Madhya Pradesh. Rains have also been lashing Telangana state for the past 6 days, with rivers and reservoirs receiving heavy inflows. Several bodies, including those of two rescue personnel, have been found there. The floods have destroyed farmlands and interrupted communications. Extreme weather in India has become more frequent in recent years, which environmentalists blame on climate change. Moving on, new official data show unemployment benefit claims in the United States are on the rise amid rising interest rates and tighter financial conditions in the country. According to the Labor Department, the number of Americans filing new jobless claims increased to an 8-month high last week. It says conditions remain tight as the Federal Reserve is raising borrowing costs to dampen demand for workers. That's amid a bleak consumer price index and rising inflation that have stoked fears of a looming recession in the U.S. Meanwhile, America's largest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, has issued a cautious note on the global economy after reporting a worse-than-expected 28% fall in quarterly profit. It has suspended share buybacks in the face of growing risks of a recession. The bank's chief executive has warned that a storm of uncertain magnitude is coming for the economy. European countries are feeling the pinch of the economic fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war. The value of the euro has now fallen to a 20-year low against the U.S. dollar. There are also concerns of a recession in major EU economies, like Germany. Hashtag Trending takes a review of the story on social media.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The exchange rates between the euro and the U.S. dollar reached parity on Tuesday, with the euro reaching its lowest point in two decades. This comes amid fears that an energy crisis caused by the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war would plunge the eurozone into an economic recession. The dip is part of a longer-term trend, with the euro weakening against the dollar 8% this year. It brings the euro closer to dollar parity, something unseen since the creation of the euro in 1999. People in Europe have been paying more for food and energy as a result of the economic consequences of the Ukraine war. Russia blames the global food and energy crises on Western sanctions against the country. Let's take a look at this chart with our first tweet of the day attached to it by Holger Scheipitz. This chart shows why euro crashed to near parity with dollar this week. Eurozone's trade surpluses have been completely wiped out because of energy crisis. Germany has slipped into trade deficit for first time in 31 years. Shortfalls in trade were also observed in France and other countries. Richard Hart has our next tweet. The euro is dying against the dollar. It's broken down under historic 30 years of support levels. Perhaps the EU should be more cryptocurrency friendly. A tweet by a member of the European Parliament, Christine Anderson, reads, "The euro is at its lowest level in 20 years. Soon parity with the dollar will be reached. The ECB, together with the decisions of the EU Commission, is creating an EU soft currency. Germany mourns the hard D mark." Danielle Lacalle said, "The euro is not just weaker versus the USD due to the eurozone trade deficit. It has been weakening since 2008 due to a worse monetary policy than the US. The fall of the euro is linked to growing fears about the likelihood of a recession in the 19-nation eurozone. Survey data has shown a slowing in business growth across the zone, and indicators suggest that the whole region could plunge into decline as the cost of living crisis tightens consumer demands. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Eklavya Gupta. Is Europe going to be the worst performer this year? With a lot of energy outsourced to Russia, price rise of 4 to 5 times already witnessed. With the most dovish monetary policy already in place, there seems to be little room. Hashtag European Union, hashtag Ukraine-Russia war. Vugar Bayramov has our next tweet. The first time the euro fell to parity with the dollar in the last 23 years as the eurozone's deepened energy supply crisis, negative adjustment of macroeconomic forecasts and economic woes continue to weaken the common currency. David Kudla said, energy, lack thereof, has crippled the eurozone economy. Germany has trade first trade deficit in 31 years. Benjamin Norton has our next tweet. The euro has depreciated so much it's now equal to the U.S. dollar for the first time in 20 years. Economist Michael Hudson argues the U.S.-led sanctions war aimed at separating Europe from Russia/China and keeping it dependent on the U.S. is making Europe an economic dead zone. The worsening of the Eurozone's outlook amid soaring gas prices is dragging down its currency. The reliance of major economies such as Germany on Russian gas has left investors unnerved, with economists forecasting an even more painful recession. And our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Maxime Bernier, the leader of the People's PSA. It would be nice if we could export gas to Germany, but we don't have the infrastructure for it now, and it will take years to build them. The Germans have to buy Russian gas now, or their economy will crash and they will freeze next winter. Bloomberg Markets said investor confidence in Germany's economy slumps to the lowest since 2011 on growing prospects of a recession and risk of Russian energy supplies shut off. Fiorella Isabel said, with grain and fuel shortages meant to increase now, that gas is no longer being transported through Nord Stream 1. Germany is destroying its own economy to stand with the U.S. and NATO in support of the regime in Ukraine. History does rhyme quite well, doesn't it? Our final comment comes from Janis Kluge. It is fashionable to predict the end of Germany's economic model these days, which is supposedly built on cheap Russian energy, as if an industrial gas bill that rises from 10 to 20 billion euros will upend a 3.5 trillion economy. Yes, there are real risks this year. That's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Thanks for staying tuned. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Welcome back. Serbia's President Aleksandar Vučić accuses the West of fighting a world war against Russia by means of Ukrainian soldiers. In a TV interview, Vučić said, "The Ukraine conflict is a global one, as the entire Western world is fighting against Russia via Ukrainians." He stressed that all the talks that it is a regional or a local conflict must be dropped. The Serbian leader warned that the situation in Ukraine is also affecting the Balkans. He vowed, however, that Serbia will spare no effort to preserve peace in the region. Russia launched its military offensive in Ukraine in February, saying it has no plans to occupy the country but to demilitarize it. Moscow accuses the West, the U.S. in particular, of adding fuel to the flame by sending lethal weapons to Ukraine.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Linda Geddes. The piece is titled "Centaurus: Virologists Express Concern at New COVID Subvariant." Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. the BA.2.75 variant, nicknamed Centaurus, was first detected in India in early May. Here, cases have since risen steeply and apparently faster than those of the extremely transmissible BA.5 variant, which is also present in India and is rapidly displacing the previously dominant BA.2 variant in many countries. BA.2.75 has also since been detected in about 10 other countries, including the United Kingdom, United States, Australia, Germany, and Canada. The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, designated it a variant under monitoring on 7th of July, meaning there's some indication that it could be more transmissible or associated with more severe disease, but the evidence is weak or has not yet been assessed. The World Health Organization, WHO, is also closely monitoring the new variant, although its chief scientist, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, said there weren't yet enough samples to assess its severity. In addition to its apparent rapid growth and wide geographical spread, virologists have been alerted by the sheer number of extra mutations BA.2.75 contains relative to BA.2, from which it is likely to have evolved. This could mean that it has had the chance to evolve an advantage over an already successful virus lineage, said Dr. Stephen Griffin, a virologist at the University of Leeds in England. It's not so much the exact mutations, more the number and combination, said Dr. Tom Peacock, a virologist at Imperial College London, who was the first to identify Omicron as a potential concern back in November of 2021. It's hard to predict the effect of that many mutations appearing together. It gives the virus a bit of a wildcard property, where the sum of the parts could be worse than the parts individually. It is definitely a potential candidate for what comes after BA.5. Failing that, it's probably the sort of thing we'll have come along next. That is, a variant of a variant. Even if it doesn't take off in other countries, its growth in India suggests it is likely to be an issue there at the very least. Dr. Peacock added, it's clearly growing pretty well in India, but India hasn't got much BA.5, and it's still very unclear how well it fares against that. Dr. Stephen Griffin cited it as yet another example of the virus's impressive capacity to tolerate changes in its spike protein, the part it uses to infect cells, and which most COVID vaccines are based on. This time last year, many were convinced that Delta variant represented an evolutionary pinnacle for the virus, but the emergence of the Omicron variant and the vast increases in variability and antibody evasiveness is a sign that we cannot, as a population, follow an influenza-like plan to keep pace with the viral evolution, said Dr. Griffin. In addition to vaccines, longer-term plans should include variant-agnostic measures to prevent infections and reinfections. This includes creating infection-resilient environments through improved ventilation, improved filtration or sterilization of indoor air, sensible reprovision of lateral flow tests, and appropriate and supported isolation periods that will actually reduce ongoing transmission, he said. Meanwhile, COVID cases have risen almost 20% in a week, with 1 in 25 people in England thought to have had the disease at the end of June, official figures suggest. As a leading statistician said, hospitalizations from the latest surge may be topping off. According to the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, an estimated 2.7 million people in Britain had COVID in the week ending 29 or 30th of June, an 18% rise on the week before, when almost 2.3 million people had the virus. In England alone, the most recent figure suggests about 1 in 25 people had a COVID infection in the last week of June, with a figure 1 in 17 in Scotland. Further analysis revealed infection levels had risen across all regions of England and in all age groups. These increases are due to rises in infections with the Omicron subvariants BA.4 and BA.5, which have been dominant since mid-June, said Sarah Crofts, the head of the analytical outputs for the COVID-19 infection survey. Scotland continues to have the highest infection rate, although it has recently increased at a slower rate compared with other regions of Britain. The total number of people in hospital in England who have tested positive for COVID stood at 11,878 on Thursday, an increase of 33% from the week before. While an increase was also evident in the number of people in hospital primarily due to COVID, with 3,749 such patients in England alone as of 5th of July.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Through these last few episodes, we've been talking about freedom of women as prescribed as in Islam. And so far, we've touched upon the topic of freedom of working outside of the home for women and also freedom of ownership and financial independence, which are really interesting topics to even be aware that they exist in Islam. Next time someone says, oh, Islam is all about oppressing women, you know, just... Yep, reality check. So, Sister Salma, today we're going to continue with these discussions, and I am excited to find out more about what other freedoms does Islam allow for female citizens of the world?
What other freedom that is a privilege to women and to show that she has the right to make her own decisions is the freedom in marriage. But with this freedom in marriage, it doesn't let you go out of hand as well in Islam. Mm. And when you see it getting out of hand, there are some things that don't go, you know, properly.
Yes, around, yes, of course.
You know, and you see that actually openly in the Western world, it happens. You know, when a woman, when a girl, especially decides her own life partner without the consent of her father or her grandfather, then. You know, it probably backfires on her because she's not made the right decision due to lack of experience that the father has, you see. So it's very important. She can choose. She has all the right to choose, like before getting married, unlike, again, the Arab Jahiliyyah and the days before the advent of Islam. This, you know, the sublime religion that is, gives a way of life. Women were not allowed to. They were like property. They were all sold off. Or even after the advent of Islam, if you go and see, you know, when everything returned back again slowly by slowly due to a lot of misguidance and wrong leaders and, you know, evil leaders.
Yeah. From the path,
so
yeah.
Again, like, and other, you know, religions, the teachings of other religions like Hinduism, Buddhism, women were taken as a commodity, really. They were, like, not allowed to choose their own life partner. And it infiltrated a little in Islam as well. All the days, if you go and see, when we ask our grandparents that, did you have the right to choose? No. We just knew that, you know, that we had to get married to so-and-so.
Super arranged marriage.
Super arranged. It's really sad. That especially when a woman who has all the, you know, right to choose and to like or dislike. Suddenly she finds somebody whom she doesn't want to talk to even.
Exactly.
Or somebody she doesn't prefer looking at.
It's heartbreaking.
It's very heartbreaking.
And it's so interesting, Sister Salma, because even Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, about whom Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has said that there is no one suitable from her, from Adam Nabi Allah till Nabi Isa, supposedly, among all the prophets that ever came and went, all the good people, no one is more suitable for her than Ali. Even in this case, Rasulullah asked her first. Yeah. Ali asked your hand for marriage. Are you cool with that? Are you good with that? Would you like to accept? And when we do the exact opposite for our own daughters, and then we have the audacity of saying, oh, it's the Islamic way of life, you know? Yeah. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Islam allows so much privilege that a woman can talk, and many times with the intention of marriage. A man can do the same, like, you know, to find out the compatibility between a man and women, if they're the right partners, suitable partners, spouses for each other. So she is like man, completely free in choosing her own partner and her own spouse. And without her consent, you know, this marriage is void, actually.
Wow.
It's void. It's batil.
Wow.
So if she is not happy and she's forced to go into a marriage, then, you know, like I feel that even if the marriage contract takes place, there's a big sinner, and that's the family who is decided and forced for her.
Exactly.
They're sinners.
They've ruined two lives.
Yes.
And probably the lives of the children that are going to be the product of this marriage.
Yes. A whole society, because the smallest unit begins with
the
children, the
yeah.
family, the first unit of the society. So that's why Islam looks at it so broadly, you know. It wants the woman to choose. Mm. And then there are no excuses left also for a woman to say that, you know, like, I'm very unhappy in this marriage.
Oh, you chose her, is, yeah, honey.
Exactly. Allah wants her to choose, to select, to think about it, to see whether that person is compatible for you or not, and then to move on with your life. And then those offsprings are those leaders, وَجْعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. And that's why that ayat really is beautiful. It goes in a kind of systematic way that if your spouses are like Qurratul Ayn for you, then, you know, the children will be muttaqeen for imam for the
muttaqeen. That is so beautiful.
Like, Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yun.
Lord, grant us, from our spouse and our children, those who are the light of our eyes, being joy to our hearts.
Exactly.
And only through that can you produce
those
highest
offspring. Exactly.
Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Yes. And that's the only way, like, and that's a beautiful thing that Allah has kept, that we can, so, you know, choose our spouses.
Mm.
So and then we can raise those kind
Comes
of offsprings
show, yeah.
that give that satisfaction and that coolness,
exactly,
you know,
absolutely.
Of the heart.
Next time someone attempts to undermine the value of love and emotional compatibility between a young boy and girl who are supposed to get married, they should really refer themselves back to this ayah, that this couple really has to enjoy each other's company. They have to be attracted to each other mentally, physically, emotionally, and their eyes have to light up when their spouse walks into the room so that they can make anything positive out of this marriage, really. Why would we want people to be miserable for the rest of their lives?
Yes, why would Allah choose? You know, it's sometimes it so happens that a spouse or a girl wants to marry someone badly, and she convinces the family, and the family knows this is not good for her, and then she sees in life how, you know, everything goes
falls
wrong.
Apart,
yeah, she's divorced. She learns the hard way then.
Mm.
And Allah does not want her to learn the hard way. Sometimes she ends up with a child and she has to raise herself. So she struggles so much. And then you see that she can't get married to, sometimes it happens that it's sad that, she, you know, she can't get that partner that she always wanted to in her, like the way if she was a spinster or a virgin, right? Mm-hmm. So all this Allah sees to the interest that if you're a virgin, you have to ask permission from your parent, that is your father and your grandfather.
We've touched upon the topic of freedom of working outside of the home for women and also freedom of ownership and financial independence, which are really interesting topics to even be aware that they exist in Islam.
With this freedom in marriage, it doesn't let you go out of hand as well in Islam. A girl is on the emotional side more. She makes quickly decisions. She wants, if somebody, you know, just admires her.
Sweeps her off her feet.
Yeah, sweeps her off her feet, unfortunately. But she doesn't realize that there's something. And that's why the relationship with the father is very
so
important.
Yes.
That she can realize that how it is. That,
exactly.
You know, to converse, what qualities should you look for. And the father also makes that girl feel appreciated in the right way. That, you know, this is not all about it. Like, you know, like just admiration. No, admiring your qualities that you have. You know, your potentials that you have. Appreciating your personality. That's very important.
It's
so
very
she
important.
Needs to be appreciated in her personality. Exactly. Because all these things are not long-lasting. So she might be swept away by her feet because of her beauty, but that'll not last.
A
man getting tired of everything around him when he sees that those right qualities are not there to make him happy.
Of course.
You know? He needs somebody to talk to, somebody to give companionship, somebody to raise his kids in the proper way, right? Somebody to not just complain and, you know, always nag around at home.
Yeah,
however actually, beautiful that person might
I know,
be. You
know? I know.
There's so many divorces happening because of that.
Exactly.
So the right decision, the right way, and the woman is also allowed to do that.
Mm.
And sometimes, ironically, it happens that a girl always is refused by her parents. And then she sees somebody so good in all, you know, ways. And then, you know, like the fiqhi point of view, she can actually be allowed to get married.
Which, exactly.
When all the qualities are there. But
the parents are still...
The parents are just, you know... Maybe.
There could be so many reasons. She could be the only daughter.
Yeah.
She could be their only child.
Possessiveness.
Possessiveness.
You know, or wanting more of wealth and position and fame and from the boy. Instead of taqwa and, you know, good deeds and
iman,
akhlaq. And I'm not saying that he should be completely poor and not compatible status. But... You know, all this, if you go and see the lower level, the fathers sometimes don't accept. They say that because so-and-so doesn't have a house, he has to live on rent, you know. But a person can probably afford to live on rent. So-and-so doesn't have a car, he has a motorcycle. But so-and-so at least has a motorcycle.
Exactly. Would
so
you?
So it would keep you happy.
Would you rather your daughter be miserable in a mansion or with the man she loves in a rental home?
Exactly. And the woman herself will realize that that rental home is better than the mansion when you have the love and the companionship.
The respect, the understanding.
Yeah, the respect.
Mm.
So all this, and you know, beautiful point is that when you look for those qualities, and this is like a lesson for the women to where they choose, the qualities that are the real qualities that Allah wants you to grow and to become perfect, then you get everything together. There's a hadith that says, one who looks for beauty would get probably beauty. One who looks for wealth would probably get that wealth and fame and everything. But one who looks for those qualities like iman and Godhead, then would get both together.
Beautiful.
Yeah, because everything would satisfy her.
Mm.
And it would grow, actually.
Exactly.
The risk is, you know, min haythu la yahtasib.
Yes.
Yughdihu Allahu min fadli. His fazl. You probably don't deserve
favors.
It, but because you were so good to your family, your wealth grows.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Thank you so very much for that interesting discourse, Sister Salma. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Trump Sought to Conceal Plans to March to Capitol, panel says. Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous,
even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House Committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The President of the United States is going to have us march there in the Capitol. Kylie Jane Cremer, an organizer of the Save America rally on 6th of January 2021, wrote in a 4th of January text shown by the panel on Tuesday as it detailed Donald Trump's efforts to gather his backers in Washington for a final last-ditch effort to overturn his election loss. Ms. Cremer added that Donald Trump was going to just call for it unexpectedly. Mr. Trump weighed announcing the move, according to documents obtained from the National Archives, which provided the investigators with a draft tweet that said, "I will be making a big speech at 10 a.m. on 6th of January 2021 at the Ellipse, south of the White House. Please arrive early. Massive crowds expected. March to the Capitol afterwards. Stop the steal." The tweet was never sent, but it was the latest evidence presented by the committee of how Donald Trump undertook a public and private effort to channel angry supporters, including right-wing extremists, towards the Capitol building, where Vice President Mike Pence and lawmakers were gathered to confirm Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory as president-elect. For more than a year, Donald Trump and his defenders have described the violence at the Capitol as a freewheeling, peaceful protest gone awry. But the hearing on Tuesday, 12th of July, laid out how the former president took a guiding role, not only in bringing the mob fueled by his election lies to Washington on that day, but also in the plan to direct it up to Capitol Hill, disregarding the advice of his closest aides. Donald Trump summoned the mob to Washington, D.C. and ultimately spurred that mob to wage a violent attack on our democracy, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House Committee. In its seventh hearing to lay out its findings, the committee situated Donald Trump at the center of the quasi-legal efforts to derail the political process and also at the heart of the unprecedented chaos at the Capitol. Over nearly 3 hours, it introduced evidence from rally organizers, from rioters and aides inside the White House, who said the former president had inspired and directed what transpired on that day. While it did not draw any direct link between Donald Trump and the domestic extremists who orchestrated and stood at the forefront of the Capitol attack, the House Committee set forth in meticulous detail how Donald Trump's words and actions united a disparate set of far-right groups and militias and spurred them to plot a violent effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. "The president got everybody riled up and told everybody to head on down," said one of the witnesses at the hearing, Stephen Ayers, an Ohio man who pleaded guilty last month to disorderly conduct charges connected to the Capitol attack. Stephen Ayers added, "We basically were just following what Donald Trump had said." Even Brad Parscale, Mr. Trump's one-time campaign manager, blamed his former boss for the deadly violence that ensued, according to evidence shown by the committee on Tuesday, 12th of July. "A sitting president asking for civil war. I have lost faith," he wrote in text messages on 6th of January 2021 to Katrina Pearson, Donald Trump's former spokeswoman, adding that Mr. Trump's rhetoric killed someone. Even as it revealed new evidence about Donald Trump's bid to cling on to power, the committee suggested that Mr. Trump was still trying to protect himself. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the panel's vice chairwoman, repeated her concerns that Donald Trump
had been quietly interfering with the committee's work by discouraging witnesses from cooperating with the inquiry. After the panel's last presentation, she said, Donald Trump tried to call one of its witnesses, and the witness, through a lawyer, alerted the House committee. We will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously, Liz Cheney said, adding that the panel had notified the Justice Department about the matter. In a statement on Twitter, Taylor Budowich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, accused Representative Liz Cheney of spreading innuendos and lies, but did not address whether the former president had tried to contact a witness. In the hearing room on Tuesday, Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, and a member of the House Select Committee, sought to draw a roadmap of Donald Trump's multi-layered effort to overturn his defeat, unfolding in three concentric rings. On the inside ring, Mr. Raskin said, was Donald Trump's pressure campaign against Mike Pence to persuade him to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for Joe Biden, as he presided over a joint session of Congress to make the official count. In the middle ring, Jamie Raskin said far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, unleashed by a December 19 tweet from Donald Trump that promised a wild rally in Washington on 6th of January, took the lead in invading and occupying the Capitol. And in the outer ring, he added, a large and angry crowd, encouraged by Donald Trump's lies about election fraud, became a political force that sought to keep the former president in power. The story the committee told on Tuesday, 12th of July, took place over three chaotic weeks at the end of 2020, starting on 14th of December, when the Electoral College met and declared Joe Biden the winner of the election. Within a day, leading Republicans like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky acknowledged Joe Biden's victory, and several aides to Donald Trump, including Pat Cipollone, the top lawyer in the White House, advised the president to concede defeat. Instead, the committee documented how Donald Trump ignored top administration officials and turned his hopes and attention to a group of outside advisers who were recommending a dangerous, an unprecedented plan to use the country's national security assets to seize control of voting machines and essentially to rerun the election. Through videotape testimony, the panel brought to life a heated and often profane meeting in the Oval Office on 18th of December 2020, in which the advisers, among them the lawyer Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's former national security adviser, fought with Pat Cipollone and other White House advisers about the plan to seize the voting machines and to appoint a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Early the next morning, once the meeting ended, Donald Trump posted the message on Twitter, urging his supporters to come to Washington on 6th of January 2021, writing, "Be there. We'll be wild." The response to the message was immediate and electric. It was quickly amplified by prominent Trump supporters with influential followings like Alex Jones, the impresario of the conspiracy-laden media outlet InfoWars, and the right-wing podcaster Tim Pool. In the darkest corners of the internet, Donald Trump supporters on websites such as thedonald.win soon began discussing bringing handcuffs, body armor, shields, bats, and pepper spray to Washington. Others talked about committing violence. Why don't we just kill them all? One person wrote on the chat board, 4chan. Every last Democrat, down to the last man, last woman, and child.
Donald Trump's tweet also had significant effects in the real world. Within days of it being posted, a pro-Trump organizing group called Women for America First changes plans to hold a rally in Washington after Joe Biden's inauguration, moving the event up to 6th of January 2021. Around the same time, the committee showed the prominent Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander registered the website wildprotest.com, which provided information about numerous protests in Washington on 6th of January 2021, with event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation. Mr. Alexander sent a text to an associate on 5th of January 2021 saying that he believed Donald Trump was going to order him and his associates to march to the Capitol, the committee showed. On 21st of December 2020, 2 days after Donald Trump's tweet about 6th of January was posted, a group of far-right members of Congress met with the president at the White House to discuss the conservative lawyer John Eastman's theories about pressuring Mike Pence to disrupt the normal workings of the Electoral College and keep Donald Trump in power. The members of Congress at the meeting included Representatives Andy Biggs of Arizona, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the committee said. The committee heard on Tuesday, 12th of July, from another witness, Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers militia, who described the group as a threat to democracy. The leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, is one of several members of the group who has been charged with seditious conspiracy in connection with the Capitol attack. And for the first time, the committee heard testimony from a criminal defendant who was at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and is now facing charges. The defendant, Mr. Iles, told the panel that he had gone to Washington at Donald Trump's direction and marched to the Capitol when the president told him to do so, and would never have gone in the first place had he known that Donald Trump's election fraud claims were false. Iles said that his participation in the riot had ruined his life and that he felt duped and betrayed by Donald Trump. I felt like I had, like, horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time, Mr. Iles said. The biggest thing for me is take the blinders off. Make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.